Overview of Western Thought was presented by Dr. David Crabtree at a Saturday conference entitled Kierkegaard's Coffee House on April 14, 2007. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2007. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
David is giving the first lecture. I go to Gutenberg, and he is our most beloved president, and he teaches. He has a PhD in history and an MA in classical Greek. He was also my first year Greek teacher. And I'm just going to go ahead and let him come on up here and get this thing rolling. We're running a little bit late, so we're going to kind of move through as quickly as possible. But I do want to just thank you all for coming today. Thanks.
I am glad to be here. I think we're all glad to be here. We have heard through Casey and others that there are a number of people here in Portland that are doing interesting things with respect to exploring the Christian faith. And we believe it to be the case that God has brought us at Gutenberg College through a spiritual odyssey that has taught us some important things. And that my hope is that we can share that with you and you can benefit that from that, and that the opposite can also be the case, that we can benefit from the odyssey, the spiritual odyssey that God has taken you on, and that we can be mutually helpful. My bifocals are not going to cooperate here, so this can be a little tricky. Let me tell you, first of all, what Gutenberg College is. Gutenberg College has existed for about 13, 14 years. It grew out of a ministry to the campus at the University of Oregon, McKinsey Study Center. It is a dinky college. It's not as dinky as it used to be. We now have about 50 students. We started out with 4. When there was a news story written about our college, in one paper where it was published, they had the headline, "Entire student body of college fits in mid-sized car." I think we have that saved in our archives somewhere. It is not as dinky as it used to be. We have 50 students now, but it's still less than D1 in sporting events. It is the distinctives. We only offer one degree, a Bachelor of Arts in Liberal Arts. Students take all the same classes. The distinctives of Gutenberg College, I would say, are one, our curriculum is it's a great books style education. So our curriculum centers around reading those works which have been most significant in the formation of Western culture. We read those and we discuss those in small groups. Second distinctive feature is we as a faculty are Christians and devoted to exploring and understanding and making known to others biblical Christianity. We take the Bible very seriously. I would encourage you to read our doctrinal statement, or I don't remember what we call it now, but what we believe. It's found in our catalog, and it can also be found online and on our website. But not all of the students who come are Christians, necessarily. They have to be willing to talk a lot about Christianity, because we do that, but they don't. We don't insist that they be Christians. So it's an interesting dynamic in the classes, and there are lots of ideas that get explored. The third distinctive I would say is that it is not primarily our interest to simply disseminate information or to prepare students for the workforce. Our primary concern is helping students develop wisdom and maturity, that it's an education to prepare people to live life rather than to make a living. So if you have interest in or are curious about Gutenberg College, I would encourage you to stop at the table at the back of the room. Terry Stoller will be there. There are books that you could look at, some that have been written by our faculty, and then there are other books that we use as textbooks in our courses, some of the great books. You can sign up for a newsletter back there. What else, Terry? Oh, and we'll be having a summer institute, which will be devoted to exploring Kierkegaard. So if you're interested in exploring the topic that we just begin with today in more detail, you can get information back at the table about that. Okay, so you can talk to him, or there are other Gutenberg tutors here, and there are Gutenberg students here, and I'm sure that you can talk to them about Gutenberg as well. Okay. The fellow who was most instrumental in developing the first Great Books College curriculum was Mortimer Adler. And Mortimer Adler made the observation that if you take the Great Books, that is, those works which in the past every educated person in the West was familiar with, That's basically what the great books are. If you take those and read them from beginning to end, it constitutes what he calls a great conversation. Because everybody speaking is more or less familiar with those who have spoken before and what they said, and is therefore to one degree or another interacting with that. So it constitutes kind of a conversation that progresses over the centuries. And we are privileged to have such a conversation available to us, one that's continuous over such a long period of time. And what you'll notice is that in that conversation, the same kinds of issues keep coming up and get discussed. And those issues are, what is a human being? How do we know things? Why are we here? Is there a God? If there is a God, what is that God like? And what ought our relationship be to that God? Those are the kinds of questions, the questions that face every human being. Those are the kinds of questions that keep coming up in this great conversation. And you see each of those issues talked about from different perspectives and different angles. And that's what makes it so interesting. Those are enduring questions that will never grow tiresome. They are vital questions, questions that we need to know the answers to. And each generation has to answer these questions on their own. As our historical context changes, different aspects of those questions come to the fore and need to be addressed. We can't just rest on what has been done in the past. Now, at Gutenberg, we have an award that we give out occasionally. Several years ago, this was before Gutenberg College, this was in the times of McKinsey Study Center, we had a speaker come down from Vancouver, B.C., Vernon Grounds, and he's a delightful speaker. He had some very helpful things to say to us. But one time when he came down, we advertised his coming and explained what he was going to talk about. And when he actually gave his talk, there was no resemblance between that and what we had advertised. So every once in a while, we give out what we call the Vernon Grounds Award. I hope I don't get it today. I forgot to look to see what I was advertised as talking about, but it's too late. I've already written my outline, and we'll go from there. What I'm going to do is try to, in very general terms, outline that great conversation that Mortimer Adler was talking about. As I sat down to write the outline for this, I realized this is a daunting task. There will be some things that I will leave out. How do you reduce a centuries-long conversation into a 1.5-hour talk? So let me first of all start with a few disclaimers. I am still a student. One of the reasons that I like teaching at Gutenberg is because I like having a job where I can continue to be a student, continue to read things that I have not read, continue to think about things I haven't thought about. And I mean that very seriously. I am still a student. I have much more to learn. Secondly, this is going to be highly condensed. I remember, it was some years back, but I still remember it, when Francis Schaeffer came out with his film series, How Shall We Then Live? One of the most common criticisms that I heard of his series was it was simplistic. And I've always thought, that's a strange criticism to make of such a work, because by nature, he's taking a humongous amount of material and trying to reduce it into something that is manageable in a short period of time. So that there is a lot of simplification that will go into that. It's inevitable. I will in advance plead guilty to the charge of simplifying what I am going to be talking about, even to being simplistic. But I think my goal is to just chart out and give you some suggestions as to how to understand the flow of Western thought from ancient times to the time of Kierkegaard. And I do have Kierkegaard in mind as the end point, and as I proceed through this, I am going to try to highlight those themes that I think are most significant for talking about Kierkegaard himself. And that means that I'm going to be emphasizing the issue of how do we know, and over the years, what have people thought about that issue? How do we know what we know? Epistemology. And before I launch into this, I would like to make one observation, and this is an observation that I have made as a result of teaching at Gutenberg, and that is that there are revolutions of thought that occur periodically throughout history where people at one time look at the world in a certain way, and then there's a more or less abrupt change to looking at the world quite differently. And I used to think that each of those changes involved an improvement, that the former view was disproved, and the new emerging view is one that is an improvement over the one that was disproved. And my studies at Gutenberg have made it clear to me that it's not that simple, that it is more likely the case that there will be a revolution in thought not because the former one was disproved, but because it became boring. It lost its explanatory value, or the circumstances changed such that the kinds of answers that it provided are not the kinds of answers that we need now. And so it's not as clear to me now that each transition is progress. It's more just we need a new way of looking at things. We need something with more explanatory value. And as we go through, I'll try to suggest why some of the changes may have occurred. the first perspective on the world that is dominant for a long period of time in human history is polytheism. In the polytheistic worldview, there are a number of gods who are the primary movers and shakers in reality. And those gods do what they do in the heavenlies, and that has implications for us here on earth. That those battles and conflicts that we see between the gods, one way or another, they get reflected in a mirror-type fashion in the affairs of earth. So we as human beings are playing a secondary role in cosmic history. We just play this little tiny bit part. The real activity is in the heavenlies. It's between the gods. And that has an impact on human history, and human beings can play a slight role in what's happening in the heavenlies by the way that we carry out our service towards the gods, pray to the gods, and influence the gods and their actions. So man's job in that way of looking at the world is to serve the gods, and generally that's serving the gods through religious practices, prayers, ceremonies. That's primarily what the gods require of us, is that we carry out those practices. And other than that, we live our lives down here, for the most part, hoping not to draw a lot of attention to ourselves and to appeal to the gods for personal help as we feel that is needed. Polytheism has the virtue of being able to explain why weird things happen. It is really a good explanation for that, because this pantheon of gods, generally speaking, is a dysfunctional family kind of situation where there's a lot of conflict. There are a lot of difficult interpersonal interactions between the gods. And so there are weird things that happen in the way that they relate one to another. And those weird things that happen then reflect down on Earth. So if we have a war between a city-state here and another city-state over here, and this city-state worships Marduk, and this city-state worships Baal, then what happens in that conflict will be a reflection of what's happening interpersonally between Marduk and Baal in the heavenlies. And in that conflict, unexpected things can happen. The weaker army might prevail. Why did that happen? It's because of the weird interpersonal dynamics that are happening in the heavenlies. So this polytheistic worldview does a good job of explaining why those weird kinds of things happen, why one city-state prevails in a war when it shouldn't have, why a drought occurs when that's not typical, why a flood occurs, sickness, those kinds of things. Greek thought took a turn from there. Greek thought begins to look at reality and become interested not so much in the weird things that happen, but in how much that happens that is orderly, that is coherent and consistent, that there are patterns out there that are observable in the world. Why would that be? Why are things predictable to a large extent? So the Greeks start with a polytheistic worldview, but they begin to think of the gods in that pantheon a little differently. They begin to think of them more in terms of impersonal forces than personalities. Impersonal forces that, for the most part, act according to certain set rules or principles. And by coming to understand those forces, those abstractions, we can better understand what's happening here in this world. It takes a couple of centuries for the Greeks to make this shift to where they begin to see the world for its orderliness and see the forces behind that orderliness. But they slowly make that shift, at least in their intellectual life. And we reach the place where the most notable spokesmen for the Greek worldview are Plato and Aristotle, who come at the end of the classical Greek period. And while there are differences between Plato and Aristotle, there is more that is shared in common between the two. They have, for the most part, a common worldview. Aristotle was the student of Plato. Plato was his teacher. Aristotle did have some differences, but for the most part, it's the shared worldview. That shared worldview understands the world as a place that is ordered to the extent that we can, through our reason, make sense of it. That the order in the world can be rationally apprehended. But that this physical world is of such a nature, it's transient, it's passing away. That matter, it rots, it decays and is gone. So that can't be all that important. Matter can't be all that important. It's changeable. It rusts, it decays. They were confident that it's not the material world that is primarily the stuff of reality. The stuff of reality is that which is unchanging. It is that which is permanent, eternal. And that this material world is really just a reflection of that which is eternal and unchanging. So they were more interested in that other realm. And in that other realm, what they found is the forms, these abstractions that we just see the manifestations of in this world. So, for instance, each of us is a human being. But what we share together is an abstraction, a form, and that is humanness. Humanness, that is something that's eternal and unchanging. Each instance of that, we die, we pass away. But the form, that's there. So they were much more interested in the realm of the forms. That's what they wanted to understand. That's what they wanted to contemplate, meditate on. Abstractions, not just humanness, but other abstractions such as truth, justice. Those are things that are very important to them. They want to understand them and to clarify those as concepts. So for them, human fulfillment comes from dwelling on those forms, dwelling on that which is eternal, contemplation of that which is eternal. Now, Plato was the student of another Greek philosopher that is very important, and his name is Socrates. Socrates was an odd fellow. He was a stone carver by trade. He was not very attractive looking, walked around barefoot much of the time, in deep thought, would lose his way going to parties in thought, show up late if he showed up at all. A very eccentric fellow. But But an interesting fellow, nevertheless, a very interesting fellow. He didn't write anything. We have none of his writings. Plato uses Socrates as a character in many of his dialogues. It is difficult to sort out what is Socrates from what is Plato. But you can discern in Plato's dialogues, it seems to me, a kind of tension. On the one hand, you see in Plato's dialogues, and this is often coming from the mouth of Socrates as a character in the dialogues, an insistence that we as human beings can't understand a lot. What we can understand is really rather narrow in scope, and we ought to focus on that which is most important to us, and that is what it means to be human, and let the rest go by the wayside. So that's one theme that you find in Plato's dialogues. Another theme that you find in Plato's dialogues is an interest in figuring out the bigger picture. What else is going on in the universe? And exploring where can reason take us in understanding other areas of human thought. If that is indeed a tension that is found in the dialogues, Socrates himself seems to be the former. Plato seems to be the one who has contributed the latter, the more far-reaching speculative kind of thought. If that's true, then Socrates is his project becomes trying to figure out what it means to be human. How do we live our lives in this reality? How do we make sense of it and live our lives accordingly? He starts out wondering what it is that he knows. A friend of his went to an oracle and asked, who is the wisest man? And came back from the oracle with the answer that Socrates is the wisest. And reports that to Socrates. And Socrates is dubious. How could I be the wisest? Because I don't know anything. So Socrates began this project where he would go out into the community of Athens and ask some of the leaders, the people who were held up as examples of knowledge and wisdom, he would inquire as to what they knew. And when they would respond with what they knew, he would press them further. How do you know that that is the case? And as he pressed them as to what they really knew, what he found was they didn't know much. And Socrates, as a result of these kind of inquiries that he conducted, came to the conclusion that where he, Socrates, was unique is that whereas other people appeared to know a lot, but in reality didn't know much, but didn't know that they didn't know much, Socrates knew that he didn't know. So he was wiser in that he knew that he didn't know. So Socrates downplayed his ability to know and understand all of reality and just focused on, well, what does it mean to be human, to live in this life? And what he concluded was that we need to use our reason to figure out what is good and true. And we need to invest every moment in our life into living with integrity, that is to say, living according to what we know to be good and true. And he went around Athens encouraging others to do likewise. He saw his role in Athens as being the gadfly. He was going to be the fly that would go and constantly bite the sleeping horse. He characterized Athens as a sleeping horse. He would bite Athens and try to wake it up from its slumber so that it would, that the people of Athens would take life seriously and realize that it is vitally important to come to an understanding of what is true and then live your entire life in conformity with that. In there is one work that was written by Plato, but it is a record of the speech that Socrates gave towards the end of his life. Socrates came into trouble with the people of Athens. As you can well imagine, if you go around showing that everybody who is held up as someone who knows something and you make them look foolish, that's not good politics. And Socrates, having pursued that course, it made a lot of enemies and was brought to trial in Athens for a charge of corrupting the youth and atheism. Those were the two charges against him. He made a speech before the people of Athens, and that's recorded in Plato's Apology. The apology consists of that speech. He made a speech to the people of Athens, arguing that he ought not be punished for what he did. In fact, he argued that he should be rewarded, if anything, for what he did, what he was doing. The people of Athens took a vote, voted that he should be punished. So then Socrates gives the last part of his speech where he's talking about what that punishment should be. And at the end, the people of Athens decide to put Socrates to death, have him drink hemlock. So Socrates dies for his commitment to being the gadfly of Athens and trying to bring the people of Athens to take life seriously and think about the things that need to be thought about. And throughout history then, Socrates has served as an inspiration for that kind of integrity. And that's no less true for Kierkegaard. Socrates is often referred to in Kierkegaard's works as a model to be emulated. Greek thought kind of goes by the wayside in a sense, that the philosophies developed by Aristotle and Plato are disrupted because of historical events. And that historical event in particular is Alexander the Great. Alexander the Great becomes king of Macedonia, leads an army to the east in which he conquers present-day Turkey. He moves into the Middle East, into the Levant, into Egypt, goes even further into Persia, Iraq, and Iran, all the way to India. He does that all in a period of about 10 years. But then Alexander dies and had made no provision for a successor. So that empire that he had conquered is divided up among four of his generals, and they begin fighting among themselves. So the stability that had existed before the time of Alexander in the ancient world, that is all thrown up in the air. And now there are peoples who have been dislocated from their former homelands. Everything is in chaos. There are wars taking place between these generals leading their armies one against the other. And into this chaos then come the Romans. The Romans expand from Italy. They begin to expand to the east. They expand into Greece, into Turkey, and eventually into the Levant as well. As a result of all of this disruption, life becomes much more chaotic than it had been during the classical Greek period. And life becomes less secure. Life is in danger in many respects. So people become interested in a different set of questions. They're no longer interested in speculative thought that ranges widely into what kind of government should we ideally have and those kinds of issues. It focuses much more specifically on how do we cope with life? As human beings, how do we cope with life? And there are a variety of answers that are posited to that question. And together, those become known as the therapeutic philosophies. Yes, skepticism, cynicism, Epicureanism, and then Stoicism. Those are the philosophies that then dominate throughout the Roman period because those are the more interesting to the Mediterranean world in this time of unrest and chaos. Stoicism is the one that seems to dominate. And Stoicism sees the world as an ordered place. The cosmos, it has order to it. And we can discern that order rationally. We can figure out what that order is. But what we as human beings ought to do is, having figured out that order, we should live in accordance with that order. Figure out how we fit into it, and live our lives accordingly such that we create the least difficulties for ourselves. And as the Stoics saw it, what we as human beings ought to do in living in accordance with that order is to live a moral life. The Stoics believed that we as human beings ought to abide by moral principles. But we should also attain to a high degree of self-control. And self-control over our emotions and our feelings, because it is through our emotions and our feelings that we get hurt, that we suffer. If we can attain to a state where our emotions and feelings don't affect us, then we will be more resistant to the difficulties that might await us out in the world. So the ideal of Stoicism is apatheia, that is, not having emotions, not having passions. Towards the time of Christ, a little bit before the time of Christ, and then after the first century after the time of Christ, as Rome expanded, it came into contact with a set of religions that it found quite attractive, and those are generally referred to as a group as the mystery religions. Thank you. The mystery religions all involved gaining some kind of eternal happiness by learning something in this life. And the way you learned what you needed to know to gain that kind of eternal happiness was to go through an initiation rite. And you, generally speaking, you paid to go through this initiation rite. I can't remember the name of this particular religion, this mystery religion, but the rite remained a mystery. But part of it was that a bull was sacrificed over you, and you are under it, and the blood from that sacrificed bull drips on you, and that's part of the initiation rite. And as you go through this initiation rite, you learn some things, that some truths, some mantras that will help you when you go into the afterlife, that you will pass on to a blissful, eternal life. So this is a step away from the rational. This is, it's the mystery rather than the rationality that is what these religions is based on. There is an author of a series of books on the history of the Christian church, Philip Schaff, who makes an interesting observation with respect to this period of time. He said that prior to this, there had been a huge emphasis on rationality and great confidence in the ability of reason to bring us to truth. In fact, too much confidence in the ability of reason to bring us to truth. And he makes the observation, an interesting observation, that in human history, that what generally follows a period of time of intense confidence in rationality is a period of gullibility. And that seems to be the kind of atmosphere that came to Rome in the first century BC and the first century AD. At the same time, there's another religious movement that becomes significant, and that's Neoplatonism. It's a kind of a resurrection of some Platonist concepts, and in particular, the emphasis on the forms as being eternal and that which is ultimately defines reality. But in Neoplatonism, those forms coalesce into the one, which is becomes God himself. That's the forms all unite in the one. And that in Neoplatonism, that becomes essentially God. But that one is ultimately above reason, beyond reason. And we come to know it not through reason, but through a mystical experience. And our ultimate happiness as human beings comes through that mystical experience. Okay. That's the atmosphere then into which Christianity emerges in the first century AD. There was at this time in the Roman culture a breakdown in morality, that is to say that the old Roman virtues lost their force. Romans no longer saw reason to abide by the Roman virtues that had existed from the founding of Rome. And furthermore, there was no basis for being moral that came along that was sufficiently compelling to establish any other basis for morality. So Rome became characterized by a licentiousness, an abandonment of morality. And in that environment, there were people who were eagerly looking for something to give sense to right and wrong action, right and wrong human action. That they sensed that things, there must be a moral base to life. But what is that? What is that foundation? And as a result, there were a number of people in the Roman Empire who became interested in Judaism. That Judaism had a strong moral base, had an explanation for why we ought to act rightly. And that became compelling and attractive to a large number of people. And they would begin to go to the synagogues and listen to the Old Testament being read and to the Old Testament being explained. And that group of people becomes known as God-fearers. When the apostles begin going out and teaching, the first converts to Christianity, for the most part, are Jews in Palestine. But as they go out from there, there are Jews in other areas that are similarly attracted to the gospel of Christ. But the next group of people that becomes interested in the apostolic message are these God-fearers, the ones who had been hanging around the synagogues and were intrigued with Judaism. So as time went on, there were more non-Jews that became incorporated into the Christian church. And by the time we get to the second and third, and especially the fourth century AD, the Christian church becomes predominantly populated with non-Jews. Many of those initially had been God-fearers, but then as time goes on, it's non-Jews who don't have that same background and body of information about the Jewish culture out of which the New Testament and the Gospel emerged. So whereas the apostles had seen Christianity as the natural fulfillment of Judaism, by the time we get to the 3rd century and 4th century, most Christians no longer see it that way. They don't understand Christianity as an outgrowth of Judaism. In fact, there is a certain amount of embarrassment among Christians about the fact that Christianity is connected with Judaism. The Old Testament was an embarrassment to them. There were many things taught in the Old Testament that they had difficulty reconciling with what they believed to be true about the world. And part of that came from their Greek presuppositions. Going way back to Plato, the notion that the forms are good, but matter is essentially flawed and corrupted. Matter is bad. That's just one of the Greek philosophical presuppositions that carried through and was part of Greek culture even as late as the 3rd and 4th century AD. So these new converts to Christianity would read the Old Testament, and they read that the God, the Creator God, made the world, made matter, and that becomes problematic. How could a perfect God make a flawed world, a world that's composed of matter? So there was an embarrassment that developed with respect to Christians and the association of Christianity with Judaism. So they began to distance themselves from Judaism in various ways, explaining away the Old Testament, wanting to do away with certain books of the Old Testament, if not the Old Testament as a whole, or looking at the Old Testament as allegories rather than as actual fact. So Christianity distanced itself from Judaism on the one hand, but on the other hand, it began to incorporate into its thought certain elements of classical Greek philosophy. It seems to me that many of the controversies that develop in the 3rd and 4th century AD arose because we have Christians who are studying the Bible and trying to make sense of the Bible, but they're bringing to the Bible Greek philosophical presuppositions and trying to fit those together, and it doesn't fit together neatly. It raises a lot of difficult questions. So some of the first issues that got debated hotly were the nature of the Trinity and the nature of the God-man Christ. And you can see why that would be a particularly difficult problem for a Greek, because you're taking that which is perfect and eternal and combining it with that which is material. How can that be put together? And that was particularly problematic given those assumptions. It seems to me, I remember having read a church history book that argued that God had so superintended the history of the church that it hammered out the most important issues first, and then has worked down to more more tangential questions as time has gone on. It seems to me that's not the case, but rather, and it is surprising to me how long it took before the church began to debate issues like, what does it mean to be saved? What are we being saved from? What is the nature of sin? What is the nature of grace? That those questions really start coming up not until Augustine do those begin to be seriously debated. So it seems to me that it is not the case that God had the church confront the most critical issues first, but rather it was a different order. In about 400, the Roman Empire fell. The Roman Empire had become a protector of Christianity under Constantine the Great. Christianity became the state religion, and it was funded and protected by the state. But then when the Roman Empire fell, Europe is thrown into chaos. And the church is without a protector. The Germanic tribes move in and begin fighting among themselves. And Europe becomes a very chaotic and dangerous place to be, with a lot of fighting between the different tribes. And no law. There's no established order. As a result, learning and philosophic thought essentially comes to a halt. The only place that learning and books are retained are in the monasteries. But for the most part, philosophic thought and learning comes to a halt. And those Germanic tribes convert to Christianity, but they convert from paganism and bring with them a lot of that pagan background that becomes, to one degree or another, enmeshed in their Christian practice. So Europe becomes a Christian continent, becomes known as Christendom, but it is populated with people who don't have a thorough understanding of the faith that they have come to embrace. During this period of time, the Middle Ages, from about 400 until we get to about, I'll take it even to 1300 or 1400, the dominant way of coming to understand what is true is based on recognition of authorities. This is the way that C.S. Lewis describes it in Discarded Image, which is a very helpful book in understanding the medieval mindset. As he describes it, in the Middle Ages, there were three authorities. One is the Bible. The second is the church traditions. And the third is that body of Greek philosophy that had been passed down and still was embraced by the church. And that is largely some Platonic concepts. And the job of the theologian was to figure out, with respect to any issue, how do you get those three authorities to line up? We know what's true. It's just a matter of figuring out how to get the authorities to line up with respect to that thing that is true. So theology became faith seeking understanding. We know what's true, we just need to come to the place where we understand it. Thomas Aquinas took on a very sophisticated project of trying to bring together what it is that we know that lines up with those three authorities, and created the Summa Theologica, which is a compendium of questions and issues that he deals with one at a time and trying to line up the authorities. And that approach to theology becomes known as scholasticism. Luther, through his experience, came to see that body of theology as being bankrupt. Luther was very conscious of the fact that he was a sinner, and that was a burning issue for him. And he understood God to be one who was basically looking for an excuse to punish us as human beings for our sinfulness. So he saw God as a meanie, a God that wanted to get us. So he was preoccupied with keeping his life pure and clean, having no unforgiven sin. So he would go to his confessor more than several times daily sometimes, just to make sure that every sin was confessed and was dealt with. And his confessor very wisely realized that Luther was preoccupied with this issue in a way that was not healthy. And so to distract Luther, he encouraged him, he gave him the assignment of teaching through some of the books of the Bible to other students, to study it and to teach it to others. And in so doing, Luther's understanding of Christianity was transformed. He came to realize that God was not someone who was looking for an excuse to zap us, but rather God was really a merciful and gracious God who wanted to extend his forgiveness to us. And having realized that, he came to understand the depth of God's grace and his mercy, and that we are saved by that grace, not by the goodness that we have. In so doing, he came to see Christianity and the way that we know what is true differently. He became convinced of the authority of the Bible, and that many of the church councils, much of church tradition, was in error, had led him astray. And for him, it was very important that it be the Bible and the Bible alone that is our authority. Let's do away with those other two pillars that had undergirded scholasticism. Let's do away with tradition. Let's do away with Greek philosophy. It's the Bible and the Bible alone. Soon after Luther's death in Europe, it did not take long before the followers of Luther, the followers of Calvin, the followers of the other leaders of the Reformation, to begin to see theology much like the scholastics had before Luther. That is to say, that they would read the Bible as one authority, and then they would read the teachings and writings of Luther as another authority and try to get those to line up. So once again, it was soon after Luther that we have the development of what some historians have called Protestant scholasticism, that it's falling back on the multiple authority way of knowing what is true. In the mid-1600s, war broke out in Europe. Wars between the various religious groups. The Lutherans fighting against the Catholics. The Calvinists fighting against the Catholics. The Calvinists fighting against the Lutherans. Wars ravaged Europe. Armies went back and forth over, especially Germany. Germany was particularly devastated. People would change sides in the middle of the war. First fighting for the Calvinists and later fighting for the Lutherans. It was a horrendous period of time in Europe. We were, during spring break, my family and I were in Germany, and one of the rooms that we saw in one of the castles in Salzburg was a room where they tortured people during this, the 30 years war, during this, these religious wars. It was a horrendous period of time. At the end of which, Europe was divided up into countries that each had their own state religion. We have areas of Europe that are Lutheran, in which Lutheranism is the state religion, other areas where Calvinism is the state religion, and other areas where Catholicism is the state religion. When Kierkegaard is talking about the church in Denmark, it's reflective of this development. Lutheranism has become the state religion in Denmark about this time, and it continued to be the case into the mid-1800s. In response to these horrendous religious wars and all of the pain and suffering that occurred, we have another line of thought that develops in Europe that comes out of René Descartes. Descartes wants to find another basis for knowing what's true rather than the creeds. There must be some other way of knowing what's true than Luther said it, or Calvin said it, or the Pope said it. He wants to find a way of coming to what's true that's more universally accepted, that's undeniable. And so he starts on a project of doubting everything. He goes through a process of doubting everything. He closes himself up into a room and decides that he's going to doubt everything and see if he can find some place on which to start building an understanding of reality that is based on reason and is undeniable, is unquestionable. And he doubts, he sees if he can doubt the existence of the chair in front of him. He sees if he can doubt the existence of the pen. And lo and behold, he can. And he keeps doubting these things. But he comes to the place where he says, there's one thing I cannot doubt, and that is that I have thoughts. Because even my doubts are thoughts. So that's something that I can count on. I have thoughts. And if I have thoughts, then I exist. He says, I think, therefore I am. So that becomes the foundation from which he begins to build rationally an understanding of the world. It's based on what he calls clear and distinct thoughts. That there are certain thoughts that are so clear and distinct, so rational, they must be true. And we can build from there. What's interesting about that is he makes then, to know something is to know something because it is rationally, it is logically necessary. That's the kind, it's certainty. That's the kind of certainty that we have in order to be able to say that we know something. In Europe then, on the continent, this kind of rationalism becomes becomes dominant. In England, it's a similar kind of perspective, but there's more of an emphasis in England on experience. So it's referred to as empiricism. But at root, they are largely the same. It's an issue of we can build our knowledge of the world on the basis of reason and reason alone. That perspective then works its way to the point of David Hume, who decides that he is an empiricist. He is convinced of the ability of reason to be the foundation on which we can know things. But he says that Descartes didn't doubt enough, in a sense. That he raises a very problematic issue, and that is, how do I know that there's anything out there? All I know is that there's something in my head, but how do I know that that reflects any reality that's actually out there? He goes so far as to say, how do I know that there is cause and effect? If I roll one billiard ball into another billiard ball, that second billiard ball will start rolling and the first billiard ball will stop. And we say that there is cause and effect. We say that the first billiard ball caused the second billiard ball to move. But Hume says, how do we know that? All we know is every time we do it, that's what happens. But can we see cause? Has anyone ever seen cause? He says, no, we've just seen juxtaposition. We've just seen correlation. We haven't actually seen cause. So Hume, through his line of questionings, calls into question whether we can know cause and effect in the world, and whether anything out there is really out there, or whether I just have these impressions in my mind. All of that's very troubling to the people to the philosophers of Europe. There is a response to that by Thomas Reed, who argues that if we reach, for one to reach that point where they doubt whether anything is actually out there, that's craziness. We can't live that way. And no one does live that way. That in fact, we know that there are things out there. And how do we know that there are things out there? He argues that we are made to be knowers, and that the universe is made to be known. That sense perception is reliable. It does tell us something about what's out there. That our sense perception, things speak to us in a natural language that we are made to be able to interpret, to translate. And it gives us reasonably reliable information about what's out there. So when I feel the surface of this board, there's a sense in which this matter here is speaking to me in a natural language that my fingers can pick up the impulse and my brain can translate. And all of that is possible because the world is made to be known, and I am made a made knower. Reed's perspective is not widely embraced on the continent. Another philosopher comes along that works on a solution to the problem that Hume had raised, and that is Immanuel Kant. And it's at this point, I'm not going to explain Kant, because I don't know that I understand it well enough. I will allow Jack to take any questions on that. But Kant comes, I'll just say he posits a solution to this problem, and I'll let Jack explain the solution. On the continent, then, there's a reaction against this kind of extreme rationality. There are people who say, you know, this kind of extreme rationalism that Descartes has started and that Hume has been using, and other philosophers as well, that there's something stale about that and something unhuman about it. It's not really an adequate understanding of how we make sense of the world. It completely bypasses our emotions, our passions. It reduces us as human beings to something too mechanical. There's something wrong with that. And so there was a movement that developed in Europe of Romanticism. And Romanticism kind of embraced the emotion, the passion of being human. And wanted to break out of the bonds of strict rationality. And there is an artistic, and that especially shows up in the artistic world, painters, composers, Beethoven fits into this, of life is more than just reason and rationality. This had an impact on philosophy as well. And one of the philosophers impacted by this is Hegel. Hegel, too, wants to kind of break out of the bonds of strict rationality and in the sense and the way it's been applied by Hume and Descartes. Hegel thinks that we really can know and understand a bigger world and a bigger picture on reality. It is rationally determined, but we can see beyond just the narrow confines of our sense experience and extrapolate further. So Hegel is interested in understanding the big picture. And he becomes very, very popular in Europe. In fact, people come from miles around to hear him lecture in the university at Jena in Germany. And very influential. He says that the dynamic behind all of reality is a kind of tension, and he refers to it as the dialectic. That there's this tension between two things, the thesis, and then there's something opposite to it, the antithesis. They are in tension and in conflict. And out of that comes the synthesis, a synthesis, something that is neither of the first two. It's neither the thesis or the antithesis, but it is something that comes out of both of them, that draws out of both of them. And Hegel sees this dynamic at play in all of reality, and in particular in history. And Hegel comes up with this grand picture of the history of the world, of mankind. And his understanding is that the history of mankind is God or the world spirit making himself known through human history. That if you look at the intellectual life of man, you have someone positing a thesis. You have someone else coming along saying, no, that's not right. You have the conflict between them and a new idea emerging out of that, the synthesis. And that synthesis then becomes a new thesis to which there is opposition, antithesis, and once again conflict and a new synthesis. And that process has been going on in human culture from the very beginning. And in fact, was reaching its culmination at the time of Hegel. That by the time of Hegel, it was getting to the place where someone like him could see where all of history was leading to and make sense of it. And as a result, in this process, there are people who play a key role in moving along the development of this, of the emerging of the world spirit, the revelation of the world spirit. And those people who play a key role in that process are world historical. They are not your average person. They are people that are making a significant contribution to the movement and understanding of this world spirit. And those are world historical people. So that's the environment then into which Kierkegaard steps in and is speaking. He's speaking to a culture in Denmark that is Christian, that is Lutheran Christian. The church is a state religion. And the theological method, to a large extent, is dominated by that kind of Protestant scholasticism, in which theologians see their job as seeing how the Bible and Luther's teachings line up to support the creeds of the church. Most Danes, if they were asked the question, "Are you a Christian?" their response would be, "Why, of course, I'm Danish." That it was a cultural reality that Danes and Christians are one and the same. And Kierkegaard is aghast at that phenomenon, because there's nothing Christian about that, and that's part of what he is speaking into, addressing, very critical of. And the other part of his environment is this Hegelian perspective that things are becoming clearer. We have almost reached the place where world history all makes sense and is culminating. And this whole system of thought is almost complete and therefore certain. That just the last few stones have to be put in place. And Kierkegaard sees around him many of the intellectuals in Denmark rushing to be the person who puts those last few stones in place, all wanting to be one of those world historical people that makes that contribution. And Kierkegaard looks at that phenomenon and just kind of shakes his head. This is craziness. So Kierkegaard sees his role in Denmark as being very similar to the role that Socrates played in Athens. Kierkegaard sees his role as being the gadfly of Denmark. It is his job to go around and bite the sleeping horse to the place where it arouses from its slumber and realizes the state in which it is in. The fact that it has completely lost its way with respect to Christianity. Everybody calls themselves Christians, but they don't know what Christianity is. Okay. That is all that I had planned to say. Do we take a break now? Do we want to do questions?
Yeah, questions would be great. We have about 10 minutes.
Okay.
You know, the Christian consensus was already breaking up, partly mm-hmm. as a result of the Reformation and everything like that, both before and then in an accelerating way after Kierkegaard. Did he contribute in any way to that breakup?
I don't have perspective on that. There were a lot of forces that were contributing to break it up, and to what extent he personally played a role in that, I don't know. I don't have a good gauge on the magnitude of that. There are a lot of contributing factors. Christianity itself is becoming kind of stale, and he's not the only one that's recognizing that. There are philosophers like Hegel that, on the one hand, Hegel, he is a Christian, but what he's saying, nevertheless, is kind of undermining of the biblical perspective. So there are a lot of different people that are contributing to it. To what extent Kierkegaard, we can attribute some of that breakup to Kierkegaard, I would be reluctant to say the magnitude. There is something that I have never done, but I am interested in doing. there are other people that begin to say things that are very similar to what Kierkegaard says. One of those is Dostoevsky, the Russian novelist. If you read Brothers Karamazov and Kierkegaard, from my perspective, they're saying things that are very consonant. I am very curious as to whether Dostoevsky knew the writings of Kierkegaard at all. They're contemporaries. Whether they knew of each other at all. My suspicion is that they did. That because at that particular point in time, Russian intellectuals were extremely interested in what was happening in Europe. I know Dostoevsky traveled in Western Europe. And I'm very suspicious that he came into contact with some of Kierkegaard's ideas, but I have no proof of that.
I don't know if this has any value, and if it doesn't, don't do it. Or okay. If Jack's going to talk about it later on, then okay. Say so. But could you jump forward in history a little bit and kind of, it's been a great overview of getting to Kierkegaard. Could you jump forward to where we are today and just kind of give us your perception of what is the driving kind of philosophical or who the people are today or what is that, where are we today in context of that kind of big spectrum? I don't know if that is helpful or not at all.
Well, I'll respond to it briefly and then we could hash that out more later. But that the project that was begun by Descartes and carried on with Hume, that perspective that we can rationally come to the place where we understand all of reality. If we're just systematic enough, careful enough, we can figure out all of reality. That kind of ran out of steam. And it ran out of steam partly in the face of World War I, in which millions of people died senselessly using weapons that were the product of that rational thought. World War II then deals another blow to that same perspective. And then the Vietnam War in the United States in particular, but also in France, it's the war in Algeria, which happens about the same time. That all of that raises the question, where is all this rationality headed? And what did it give us? It gave us nuclear weapons. It gave us the ability to destroy ourselves. It gave us senseless wars. So in Western culture, people begin to reach the perspective that rationality is not all that it's cracked up to be. It really doesn't have as much explanatory value as we thought it did. And what does it lead to? It just leads to self-destruction. So there was a reaction against that. And the reaction, there were several reactions against it. I mean, the 60s movement, part of that was there's got to be another way to get in touch with reality. There must be some chemical that will do it. So let's try them all. So there were various different approaches that were used to try to find another way. But there were voices that began to say, well, you know, Hume was right. We don't know that what is out there is actually out there. All we know is what's happening in our head. And we feel a sense of certainty about it because there are people around us who have similar things in their heads. But what we believe to be true about the world is not because we know it to be true, but because it's culturally supported such that we believe it to be true. And that's all that we can know is that construct that we have in our head. So truth does not exist. All that exists is the constructs that we have in our heads. And that's usually referred to as postmodernism. And so we've reached a point in human thought where there is huge skepticism. about our ability to know what's really out there. And huge skepticism about whether there really is truth that exists that could even be found if at all. And that's had huge implications for how we talk to one another, how we communicate, and a shift from an emphasis on argument to now an emphasis on image arguments with words, persuasion with words, to a shift towards images and
story's
big, yes. That those are the means by which we communicate. Been a huge shift.
I had a question. It was earlier on when you were kind of laying the basis for the flow of thought that you just gave us. And it related to questions dealing with epistemology, which you said was kind of going to be your focal point as you were laying things out historically. I believe that you said that you referred to someone, and I can't remember his name, who said that evolution in worldview had to do either with a change in needs. You mentioned a change in needs, a loss of wonder or kind of staleness, and along with that, kind of intertangled with that, the idea of explanatory power diminishing. Mm-hmm. So a loss in wonder is not the same thing as losing explanatory power. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious about how those ideas, like if we're thinking about evolutions in thought, are people changing their worldview? Like, how do those relate to each other? Loss of wonder is one thing. Change in explanatory power is another.
Yes.
And in a sense, you could lose wonder. You could be bored with an idea, and that wouldn't mean that it ceased to explain.
Right.
I mean, I guess that's all obvious, but I'm kind of curious about the interconnection of those two ideas and to what degree do you think they're in conflict or that they work together?
Well, they are different things, but cultural change is a difficult thing to get a handle on. That for one person, the driving factor may be a loss of explanatory value. For another person, they're bored with the old one. So it's often hard to characterize which one is predominantly at play.
And you're not saying that there's something causal between those two issues themselves, like there's something causal between the idea of a loss of wonder and in some way people not thinking that the explanatory power is there.
Not necessarily,
okay.
Yeah. I don't think I attributed that idea to anyone. But if I were to point you somewhere, it would be Thomas Kuhn's Structure of a Scientific Revolution. I don't know if you've read that or not, but it's a curious book. I read it when I was an undergraduate, and I didn't really understand what the implications of what it was saying. And reading it more recently, I understand better what he's talking about. In that book, Thomas Kuhn made a study of scientific revolutions at different times in history. And at least as I was taught science as growing up in the schools, it's this process whereby you come up with a theory and that theory is tested, and in that testing it either is supported or it is shown to be false. And if it is shown to be false, then you come up with another theory that makes the adjustments such that now it accounts for this problem that developed over here. But each time a new theory comes along, it's a step closer to ultimate truth. That's the pattern that was presented to me as I was studying science in high school. Thomas Kuhn is saying, if we look at scientific revolutions, That's not really the way it works. The way it really works is you'll have a perspective that dominates the field, and anyone coming along that has challenges to it, they don't get very far. They get kicked out. They don't pass. They don't whatever. They can't get published. But occasionally, someone will come along with another way of looking at things and somehow is able to gather a following and even make his way into getting some works published and get a hearing. And then we get a situation where we've got the old paradigm, the old view, and this new one. And what happens is largely a political issue. It's not an issue of, it's not purely what is closer to the truth, the way he describes it. It's more political. And this new paradigm, it may win or it may not win. If it wins, then it will establish itself in the universities and the departments. And any challenges that come along to it, it will treat the way that the old paradigm treated challenges to it. So the way he describes it, it's not each move is a step closer to the truth, but rather it's this political struggle that takes place between two paradigms, and it's not necessarily related to how true they are or how well they explain it.
Yeah, when I use the word, if I use the word evolution in worldview, I didn't necessarily, I wasn't assuming that using the word evolution meant that it was progress towards the truth. Okay. I just meant change.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, okay,
yeah.
But yeah. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Just to follow up on that, though, he does think that Einsteinian theory is better than Newtonian theory.
He's not saying that there is. Well, it's a little hard to know exactly. I think it's a little hard to know exactly what he's saying, but I think what's clear is he's saying that not every step is made because it's closer to the truth. You see what I'm saying? It may be, but it's not necessarily. There are other things at play that we need to be aware of.
Since I'm holding the microphone, mm-hmm. maybe I'll ask a question. Mm-hmm. Could you talk a little bit about, like, I guess I think that even though Kierkegaard is reacting to Hegelianism, it seems that he hasn't sort of left the orbit yet.
He hasn't, pardon?
Left the orbit.
Of Hegelianism?
Yeah, I mean, still sort of embroiled in the dialectic, just maybe choosing individuality versus, you know, the collective, you know, coming down on one side or the other. And that's something that's disturbed me a little bit about Kierkegaard's thought, as much as I admire.
You mean that, do you... That is an influence from Hegel?
Yeah, mm-hmm. That he's obviously a child of Hegel.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that could be. We are all products of our culture. I mean, that is something that postmodernism, I think, has right. We are affected by our culture to a level that we are not aware of. And I think... it wouldn't be surprising to me that Kierkegaard also would be a child of his culture. Okay, do we need to stop? Okay.